All right, before I get started, I just want to make an announcement. Justice Hardesty, as you can see, is not with us today. He had to take care of some family matters up north. And he will be listening to the arguments. He'll be participating in the deliberations, but he's not here today. So with that, let me call up docket number 81018, Cohen versus Paddock. Counsel, are we ready to proceed?
We are.
Okay, come on up and feel free to take your mask off if you would like.
Good morning. May it please the court. Phil Irwin on behalf of the appellant Ruth Cohen. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. This consolidated appeal presents two distinct issues. The first and most important issue, whether Ms. Cohen's suspension from the practice of law rendered her fee-splitting agreement with her former partner, Mr. Pata, illegal and unenforceable under Rule of Professional Conduct 5.4a. The second issue is whether the district court abused its discretion by denying the Pata defendant's request for attorney's fees on the basis that Ms. Cohen's decision to reject an offer of judgment was not grossly unreasonable or in bad faith. Because a successful result on the first issue will moot the second issue, I will devote the majority of my time to the district court's summary judgment order. Before I get there, however, I want to address a threshold issue of whether Ms. Cohen's arguments regarding the district court's summary judgment order are properly before the court. We acknowledge that Ms. Cohen's legal authority on which she relies in briefs and her supporting arguments were first raised to the district court in a motion for reconsideration. Nevertheless, under Arnold, this court can hear these arguments and consider the cases because they are part of the record on appeal, and the district court considered them on the merits when it denied Ms. Cohen's motion for reconsideration. The district court applied the clearly erroneous standard, Ms. Cohen's arguments, before engaging in a detailed, albeit incorrect, analysis of why the case law does not apply. Because the district court denied Ms. Cohen's motion for all of the reasons contained in its order, we submit that the court can consider Ms. Cohen's legal authority and supporting arguments under Arnold. Turning to the substantive issues, there are a handful of undisputed facts from the district court's summary judgment order that we submit are relevant to the court's consideration. First, Ms. Cohen had an active law license when she and Mr. Pata entered into the December 2014 dissolution agreement that resolved her partnership interest in the firm's pending contingency fee cases. Second, Ms. Cohen did not have an active role prior to the execution of the dissolution agreement, and the parties did not anticipate or expect that she would perform work on the cases after the contract was signed. To that end, Ms. Cohen did not perform any work on the pending contingency cases after the contract was signed. In short, her financial interest in the cases arose solely out of her status as a partner in Cohen and Pata. And lastly, there's no dispute that Ms. Cohen did not satisfy her CLE requirements in 2016, that she was administratively suspended from the practice of law in 2017, and that she did not reactivate her law license until December 2019. And during the time period in which she was suspended, two of the cases that were subject to the dissolution agreement settled for significant sums from which Ms. Cohen claims the vast majority of her damages in the underlying action. Again, all of these facts are taken from the undisputed facts in the district court's summary judgment order. Now, the Pata defendants spend a great deal of time in their papers discussing the importance of CLE requirements and Ms. Cohen's actions that led to her suspension. I suspect we're going to hear the word protest a lot during today's argument. To be clear, I'm not here to defend Ms. Cohen's decision-making or minimize the importance of CLE requirements. Our position is that Ms. Cohen's suspension in 2017, regardless of whether it was for failure to comply with CLE requirements, attorney misconduct, or for something as egregious as embezzling client funds, does not absolve the Pata defendants of their requirement to compensate Ms. Cohen for her financial interest in the contingency cases under the dissolution agreement.
Well, sir, before we move on to that piece, just factually, what do we do with the buyout agreement in 2016? How does that affect our analysis?
I don't believe it affects the court's analysis on this appeal because the district court did not reach that issue. In the summary judgment order, the district court's ruling was exceedingly narrow just on the issue of her suspension, and the district court also ruled that there were genuine issues of material fact related to the buyout agreement that would have allowed Ms. Cohen to proceed to trial. Turning back to the suspension, the reason that her suspension did not eviscerate her rights under the dissolution agreement is because the district court's findings established that she had completed her duties on the cases to the extent any existed in the first place when the parties entered into the contract in 2014, at which point in time Ms. Drupata assumed full responsibility for the cases. We have cited persuasive case law from four other jurisdictions, Texas, Iowa, Missouri, and New Jersey. These cases address almost identical fact patterns in the context of those states' ethical rules prohibiting fee splitting with non-lawyers. In each of those cases, the courts determined that the attorney had completed any legal work that was owed to the client prior to the suspension. Because the attorney had fulfilled his or her duties, these courts held the public policy reasons that bar compensation altogether or limit that compensation to quantum merit do not apply because there was no abandonment of the client. As the Lee Court put it, to hold otherwise would undermine Rule 5.4A's integrity by artificially expanding it simply to inflict additional economic harm and damage contract rights.
Well, counsel, what point in time are we focusing on? Are we focusing, should we be focusing on? When they entered into the dissolution agreement, is that our operative time? Was she suspended or not suspended then? When she was suspended, when the case hit, what points in time are you asking this court to?
I think the point in time that the court needs to look at to determine whether Ms. Cohen had fulfilled her duties is the time of suspension. Our position is that she had done that to the extent any duties existed when they entered into the dissolution agreement more than 2 years prior to the suspension. Now, had Ms. Cohen continued to share responsibility after the execution of the dissolution agreement, then this matter would fall into the split of authority that was addressed by the district court.
Didn't she continue to work for the firm in 2014 for approximately 2 years roughly after the dissolution agreement?
I believe the record demonstrates that she was hired to do some independent contractor work, mainly in employment law matters. But the summary judgment order, the testimony, and frankly, I think the parties agree that she did not perform any work on the contingency cases at issue. And on that point, I think the AM Wright and Cruz cases from Texas are kind of instructive on the dividing line here. The Cruz court stated that the relevant inquiry in deciding which rule to apply is whether or not the attorney had completed all of his or her duties prior to the suspension. There, the Cruz court determined that the attorney had not fulfilled his or her duties because the fee-splitting agreement at issue expressly contemplated that the attorney would continue to share responsibility. Similarly, in AM Wright, the court determined that there was a question of material fact on the issue because the fee-splitting agreement referenced day-to-day handling, and that raised a question as to whether the attorney would participate in the representation going forward. Here, however, the district court expressly found that the parties did not expect or anticipate that Ms. Cohen would continue to perform work on the cases after the execution of the contract. The district court also found that she did not perform any material work on the cases prior to the execution of the contract and perform no work after. And that's for good reason, because the PATA defendants vigorously argued in the court below that Ms. Cohen had nothing to do with the cases to ward off a potential claim for quantum merit. And Ms. Cohen did not contend that she worked on the cases. Accordingly, we think the rules contained in the case law that we have submitted is plainly applicable here under the undisputed facts as found by the district court in its summary judgment order. In an attempt to avoid this case law, the PATA defendants try and flip her lack of involvement on its head by arguing that she did not earn her financial interest by performing value-creating acts. The case law we have cited does not require the performance of value-creating acts.
Let me pause you just for a moment. When approaching this case, and neither side really walks the court through this, but we have the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct, which are ABA knockoffs, basically.
Correct.
And you look at the different rules that speak to this, because that's the source of the prohibition that they claim violates public policy by allowing her to participate in this. Those rules address a deceased lawyer's, like the estate, being able to collect fees, and they address they mention in 5.4 retirement plans, but they don't really speak directly to a situation where a lawyer who's a partner in a firm whose revenue is largely contingency fee based retires and doesn't want to practice law anymore.
Right.
And there's a buyout. There's a goodwill provision in 1.5, but it doesn't quite speak to this situation. So I would like your comment on what the, and I, you're arguing a bit against yourself in this question, but what's the source of the prohibition as far as violating public policy? There's the fee splitting issue, but at the time the agreement was made, she was licensed. So, and she didn't work past that point. But I'm surprised there is no direct provision for this situation in those rules in the commentary.
And I agree. I think the only prohibition that's been mentioned is just the first sentence in Rule 5.4A or 04A. And I think, you know, both parties agree that the exceptions do not apply. And this goes
including the one for A3 about a compensation or retirement plan. That seems to me to be existing employees? I don't know.
I agree. It's not particularly clear to me. We haven't contended that that applies here.
Okay.
And this goes to the PATA defendant's argument that, you know, we failed to identify a textual defect and the court need not look any further than the plain language of the rule. But Nevada law is clear that if a rule is silent, which I think Rule 5.4A, as well as the rest of the rules are, the court will look beyond the plain language.
And also, when's the point in time at which the fee sharing occurs? I mean, is it the agreement to share fees that will be delivered in the future, or is it?
I believe the fee sharing agreement established the right to receive fees and established the completion of her duties. I think, and I believe the court just issued a ruling on this case that, or on this issue, that in a contingency fee case, the damages don't accrue or the fee doesn't accrue until it's, you know, achieved, until there's a settlement. So I don't think there's any dispute that the fees were earned during that period of suspension. Our point is that that Rule 5.4A doesn't bar her from recovery.
Okay, you got 334 remaining. You'd like to reserve that?
I will reserve that. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Justice Paragary. May it please the court, Dan Pulsenberg for the respondents. Let me take an unusual approach, at least for me, of going through the procedural history to show the arguments and how they change, because that will help you both with the substantive arguments and our argument that this issue is waived. So we made a motion for summary judgment, and we said, look, Ms. Cohen is not licensed at the time the fees were owed. And counsel just conceded that the operative time is when the fees vested. Now, I'm not sure Justice Herndon is going to totally agree because of the dissent in Capriati construction, but that's clearly the law that applies in situations like this. So we made the motion, said she's not a lawyer. We can't split fees. 5.4 says a lawyer will not share fees with a non-lawyer. Their opposition was only, okay, now I'm a lawyer again. So now it's okay. And there was no authority for that, even under AA Primo, where somebody came in after the fact and said, look, there's a statute that says
they did at the moment you filed your motion. Let's leave the reconsideration issue out of it. Let's say she reinstated the day after she got your motion. So
she attempted to reinstate, and the CLE board authorized her reinstatement the day after we made the motion.
So there's no reconsideration. Let's say it was briefed adequately by your light with the Lee versus Clark and all those cases in there.
Then I'll go right into the substantive arguments. I was just doing the chronology so it would show my waiver argument. We made a textual argument under 5.4. It says a lawyer cannot share fees with a non-lawyer. And Ms. Cohen, at the time the fees vested, at the time the fees were earned, was a non-lawyer.
So you're, Mr. Pulsenberg, you're taking the position that it is a very express and finite time period, meaning essentially the day the fees vest, if she's not a lawyer, if she gets her license back one day later, for instance, then you're not entitled to anything.
Well, yes, because and we cited a number of cases on page 28 and 29 of our answering brief. But let's remember here that even though I'm drawing that sharp line, the sharp line wasn't here. She was suspended for 32 months. It was years after she was suspended. She tried to get, after the fees were earned, that she tried to get reinstated. So
no, I get that, but you can understand the fear, right? Who controls the settling and collecting of fees during a period of time in which lawyer A, for instance, has separated based on a dissolution agreement? Lawyer B is going to control that.
So but there's
because they're still running the firm.
Okay, let me explain my bigger issue on this case when you look at the different approaches that the parties and the judge took. I don't think the judge set out to draw a hard and fast line. I think Judge Gonzalez took the circumstances of this case and said, you know, this calls for a reasonable, moderate approach. We had argued what she considered to be the moderate approach. If you are not licensed at the time the fees are earned, you can't share in the fee, but you can get quantum merit for any work that you did before.
But isn't that mixing it up? I mean, she had terminated her association with the law practice, and they adopted this as a measure of what she would be entitled to as her buyout. And if she had entered into that agreement and then passed away, it's quite clear under the rules that she would have been entitled to the measure of that recovery.
But if it were a buyout, which begs Justice Stiglitz's question.
The payment for the dissolution.
See, I don't have a problem with the buyout. If the dissolution agreement had said you will get X amount, then that wouldn't be fee sharing. That would be a purchase. This was clearly, no matter how you characterize it.
But what about, okay, so you're saying that you think it offends public policy to have the price of the dissolution payout be measured by recoveries and contingencies down the road?
I'll go a step further. I'll say that it is fee splitting if you do it that way, whether it's a contingency fee. If I retire from Lewis and Rocha and my retirement plan is I get X percent of any fees in my cases, whether they're hourly or flat fee or contingency fee, that's fee shifting. And if I stop being a lawyer, then we can't share fees. Now, there are ways you could stop being a lawyer and you're still in the system. And you can go inactive. You can resign your commission, which you'd have to go to the Board of Governors and this court to be able to do this. You just can't unilaterally say, okay, I'm not paying my reinstatement fee, I'm not doing CLE. And that was the deciding factor for Judge Gonzalez. Remember, there are three courses. There's my course, which is if you're not a lawyer at the time the fee is earned, you can't get fee shifting. The Texas approach is if you ever are suspended or disbarred, you have abandoned your client, you can't get any fees ever, even quantum merit.
But there's no, that's kind of a red herring. There's no abandonment here. Mr. Pata and his law firm.
I'm not the one saying there's an abandonment. Yeah. I mean, I got some amici who are saying it's an abandonment, but they're the ones who are characterizing my argument as saying it's an abandonment. So they can call under this narrow exception, as Judge Gonzalez says, under this narrow exception, if you contract to transfer cases you have to somebody else and get an origination fee for that, and it's in the contract, you don't have to do anything else. And then that's an exception to the Texas, that's Lee versus Cherry, that's the exception to the Texas rule. I'm not arguing the Texas rule. And I'm arguing a textual approach. And the reason my textual approach works, Justice Pickering, is that because you bring up the five exceptions. None of those exceptions come close to dealing with what we're dealing with here. And under expressio unius est exclusio alterius, oh, Mr. DeChristopher is going to be upset at my Latin pronunciation, I said in an argument earlier, expressio, one thing is exclusio, everything else. It's not that the rule is silent on this point. It has express exceptions for when the rule will let you fee shift with non-lawyers. Often we're talking about giving to the estate of a deceased, disabled, or disappeared lawyer, but we handle those situations.
And yes, it's. I wouldn't say it's a knockoff.
Conceptually, why would that situation be different? If the fee splitting arrangement is a buyout from your whatever you brought into the firm, and you leave, is that I'm struggling.
As long as you're still a lawyer, that's okay.
Okay, so she makes the agreement; she's still a lawyer, undisputed.
Right.
So now, whether she gets the money depends at the time a case is settled.
Yes, the Garland case settled while she was still licensed. And I realize, Justice Herney, we're not manipulating when she gets suspended. There's no indication here that we knew.
I understand, but I think part of it is you're rubbing two things up against each other that are kind of obstructing, right? There's a contractual dissolution agreement, which everybody seems to concede was legally valid and was proper, and then the rule of non-sharing of fees with a non-lawyer. What Judge Gonzalez's order doesn't really seem to address in my mind, and I apologize if I missed something, that timeliness issue in there, right? What happens if she becomes active again, and how long does somebody's obligation, if it's a legally valid contractual obligation, remain?
Well,
or can it evaporate?
I think she does address it, because, and that's why I'm saying she took an approach even more moderate than I am. What she said is, you know, if this had just been some accident and excusable neglect and you were reinstated, then I think I could overlook that. But here where you willfully, deliberately, intentionally stayed suspended, I'm not going to use the word, Phil, under those circumstances, she just didn't think that was an appropriate situation in which to forgive the circumstance.
But taking out the concept of blame that's being injected, if she just decided, I don't want to practice law.
Right.
So she just...
Didn't pay her dues.
Yeah,
she's not a lawyer.
Law. There's no principle involved here. The principle is I don't want to be a lawyer anymore.
Then you're not a lawyer.
And you don't get the money.
No, you don't. Because if you don't want to, and that's what I was alluding to earlier, if you want to stop practicing law, there are ways to go about that. You can go inactive. You're still subject to the discipline of the state bar in this court. You can resign your license, which can't imagine anybody doing it, but we had three people do it last month. And that goes to the Board of Governors and the state bar and their regulations for whether there's any pending discipline. Somebody can't just take it on their own to exempt out of the system. And that's what I think... my argument is really 5.4.
But do the rules make those distinctions? Do the rules say that if you go inactive, you can still collect?
No.
Your expressio unius argument doesn't include what you're saying.
I may be wrong on whether you resign, but at least that's a way to stay. And I may be wrong on that. You may not be able to get fees under that circumstance.
But you're saying because in your estimation she was a scofflaw when it came to these rules, that's a worse case than...
I think I know what a knockoff is. I'm not so sure I know what a scofflaw is. But yes, that is what I'm saying. And I think that's what Judge Gonzalez was saying. She was trying to adapt a moderate rule for circumstance that will never come up again.
But essentially what we're saying is you can't have a dissolution buyout agreement like this for a contingency fee. Unless
for a percentage
of
fees.
You cannot. So you just can't do it.
And even if the buyout, you can have it. You certainly can have it as long as you're still a lawyer. And the easiest way to do it is to still be involved in the firm in some way. And then you're looking at Rule 1.5, and how you share fees within a firm isn't subject to the same kind of rigorous scrutiny.
What in your mind, I mean, if we accept that interpretation, and let's assume for this hypothetical that all the work that's required to be done prior to the dissolution agreement is done, and the attorney removes from the firm, and then things become collectible, and at that moment in time, the attorney is suspended. Maybe it says Justice Stiglitz reference. They just didn't want to practice law anymore. What's the wisdom, the logic, the reasonableness of adopting the rule that you're proposing here that says they get nothing? They get nothing, even though they did everything they were supposed to do before they ever went inactive, and they had entered this agreement before they went inactive.
Right.
What is the logic as to why that would be fair and just?
Well, and
Judge Gonzalez goes on for a little more than a page about why their argument on rehearing doesn't apply. So, and one of the things she's saying is this isn't, even under the Lee versus Cherry exception, this isn't that kind of contract. It would have to be a referral or an origination contract. But even I find those reprehensible. Because what we're saying, and this is a good point,
but law firms' only source of income is legal fees. I mean, this isn't specific to contingency fees necessarily. Right. In your literal reading of 5.4, it's fee splitting, period.
If it's a percentage of fees, my example about me and Lewis and Rocha, if I quit and they give me a percentage of hourly fees that are brought in and I choose to stop being a lawyer, then yes, that's fee splitting and that's inappropriate.
Do you have authority for that proposition?
I think all the cases that we set out in 28 and 29, some are contingency fees. I think at least one is an hourly fee. But mine's a very textual approach. Now, Judge Gonzalez was a more moderate approach, as I say. And what she was pointing out is all these arguments that they raised on rehearing, she wasn't saying I'm considering them, wasn't just saying I'm considering and rejecting them. She was saying, here's why I'm rejecting them instead of considering them, because they don't even apply. They're not a referral agreement. They're not an origination agreement, which are exceptions to the hard and fast rule that says that a non-lawyer gets nothing. Under my approach, the majority approach is that non-lawyers can't get fee shifting, but they can get quantum error. This is just a circumstance where she's claiming that she doesn't get quantum error.
Did she say my quantum error would be 30% of contingency?
No, I don't think, unlike an offer of judgment, that wouldn't be quantum error.
She said that's the reasonable value of my services.
Quantum error literally translated is the amount deserved with absent. No, it would be the value of the work done. That's the way we usually do quantum merit. But I don't think these issues are properly presented. I think Judge Gonzalez properly rejected them and ignored them. And I also think that this is a situation that's hardly ever, maybe never, going to come up. And so I don't think we need to fashion a rule of law to handle this situation.
And Mr. Pulsenberg, you'll agree, though, that even the kind of alluded to moderate approach by Judge Gonzalez would run afoul of the rule. She couldn't have done that either. She couldn't have said, well, it was an accident when you got suspended. Therefore, I'm going to set that aside. That wouldn't matter. Under what you're proposing today, that wouldn't have saved this. Am I right? I mean, Judge.
Well, she did rule my way. But
I appreciate that. What I'm saying from the perspective of you're telling us, hey, you can't fee share with non-lawyers. So it actually doesn't matter why you're a non-lawyer, period. Even though Judge Gonzalez kind of alluded to the fact that it was an intentional suspension, it was a principled suspension, she couldn't have ruled differently under what you're proposing.
Well, yeah, my rule is textual and a little harder and faster. Her rule wasn't, and she was the judge. But she considered the circumstances. Also, that's also a reason why I think she denied the attorney's fees. Because she was looking for a reasonable, moderate approach. Let me concede the attorney's fees right now, because I think those are tied in with the approach that the judge took to take a reasonable approach under the circumstances. Circumstances I don't think are going to be repeated. Thank you, Ronnie.
Okay, you got 3 minutes, 29 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address the various approaches and the purported exception to the Texas rule that was just discussed. As I mentioned earlier, the dividing line in which rule to apply is whether or not the services have been completed and the duties fulfilled. If the contingency fee contract has not been fulfilled by the lawyer, then you fall into the split of authority, where under Texas you get nothing, or under Judge Gonzalez's approach you would get quantum merit. If the services have been completed, then you fall into the line of cases that we have cited, where you are entitled to recover because no more duties are owed. And I think the Simpson court expressly recognized this when it went through the split of authority, the majority view, the minority view, and said that the court was not required to accept or reject the majority or minority rule to resolve the case because neither applied, because the duties had been completed. So I think the way that the district court and the PATA defendants have looked at the various approaches is simply wrong. On the textual argument, I understand the strict textual argument, but the other jurisdictions we have cited have very similar, in some cases the exact same, like Texas, ethical rules prohibiting fee sharing with non-lawyers. And that didn't stop those courts from going beyond the text to apply the rules that have developed over the course of the last 20, 30 years on this issue. As far as the cases cited by the PATA defendants, none of those cases address a factual situation like this one. And in fact, many of the cases, especially the Royden case, the Cruz case, that they cited in support of their arguments actually support our position because they go to this dividing line on which rule to apply. On the label on the agreement, whether it's an origination or referral contract, that doesn't matter. This court has recognized that you shouldn't just look at the labels. The key consideration, again, is whether the duties were fulfilled, and they were here when the dissolution agreement was entered into in 2014. And as a final point, you know, I want to point out that the PATA defendants are actively seeking to use Rule 5.4A to gain a substantial windfall in the face of serious allegations and evidence of fraud and breach of fiduciary duty, but for Ms. Cohen's administrative suspension for conduct that had nothing to do with the contingency fee cases at issue in this proceeding, she would have gone to court and Ms. Cohen would have had her, she would have had her trial. Instead, by virtue of this suspension, the PATA defendants are going to gain a windfall for more than $3 million, irrespective of whether Mr. PATA defrauded Ms. Cohen or breached his fiduciary duties. That is not an equitable result, and it certainly doesn't advance the public policy interests embodied in Rule 5.4A and the Supreme Court rules governing CLE compliance. With that, I'll take any other questions, or else I'll sit down.
Colleagues, any questions? Nope.
Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you for your arguments today and your briefing in this matter. The matter stands submitted. The court will stand in recess until 2 o'clock this afternoon.